Today is January the 12th, 2022. We are looking forward to returning to the studio to do live shows and taking your phone calls. And when is that? Well, hopefully soon. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. If you have had problems signing on to prn.fm, try prn.live. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Sonos wins patent lawsuit against Google. Sonos sued Google in 2020 after saying that Google took advantage of its partnership with a company to use Sonos intellectual property on Google's products. Google and Sonos have been battling it out in the courts for a while now, with Sonos alleging that Google infringed on its patents. On Thursday, January the 6th, 2022, as reported by the New York Times, the United States International Trade Commission, known as the ITC, has ruled in favor of Sonos. The commission determined that Google infringed on all five of Sonos' patents that were at issue. Products that infringe on those patents include the Google Nest smart speakers, Pixel phones, and the Chromecast streaming device. However, according to a Google spokesperson who said, "We do not expect any impact to our ability to import or sell our products." And this is likely due to an ITC already having approved Google software workarounds, so the products will no longer be infringing on the patented technologies. One of the workarounds led to the need to adjust each speaker individually instead of using the group volume controller. Other workarounds might have users needing to download a special app to set up certain devices on their network. The loss of the ability to adjust volume of an entire Nest or home speaker group at once is a feature downgrade of the product. For instance, instead of being able to say, "Hey Google, set volume to 40% on living room speakers," you have to change the volume for each one individually using either the Assistant or the Google Home app or the Nest Hub display. Google responded to the ruling by rolling out a number of software changes and tweaks that circumvent the patent infringing technology in question, a measure which Google believes will not impact its ability to import and sell its products. Sonos made a name for itself with its innovative multi-room speaker technology, allowing a network of speakers throughout a house to communicate with each other intelligently and be centrally controlled with a smart device. Specifically, there are five patents that were alleged to have been infringed upon, and the ITC has ruled in favor of Sonos for all five. They include the ability to adjust the volume of multiple devices at once on the same network, the synchronization of multiple devices on a network, and the initial setup of such devices. The commission has given Google 60 days to comply before the ban takes place. It is expected that Google will roll out software updates that implement workarounds to avoid infringing on these five patents, thus negating the import ban. In 60 days, Google could be banned from shipping Pixel units to the United States. The ITC's ruling could block Google from importing Pixel devices into the States in 60 days. Those infringing devices would be banned from entry in the United States, depending on the result of a presidential review. President Biden could veto the ruling. While such an action by sitting president is rare, however, back in 2013, President Obama vetoed an ITC trade ban against the iPhone 4 and some iPads that was the result of a suit filed by Samsung. Google could escape the ban by making changes to its software. Sonos says that Google can pay a fair royalty for the technology it has misappropriated. Google responded by saying, "While we disagree with today's decision, we will ensure our shared customers have the best experience using our products and do not experience any disruption. We will seek further review and continue to defend ourselves against Sonos' frivolous claims about our partnership and intellectual property. The big news here is that the Pixel phones are involved in a limited exclusion order. The Pixel 6 and the Pixel 6 Pro were released last October, as demand for the Pixel 6 line has been very strong. If you have multiple Google smart speakers in your house, you may want to be aware of certain legal rulings, because it's going to affect how your speaker groups work. After the U.S. International Trade Commission ruled that it was infringing on Sonos patents, Google has already announced software workarounds, including the need to adjust each speaker individually instead of using the group volume controller, and that users will no longer be able to adjust a speaker group's volume with their phone's volume rocker. It blames this change on a recent legal ruling. Google also says that a small set of users will need to use a specific app to set up their smart devices and update them, and Google is warning users that if their speaker group contains products from other manufacturers, they may need to be updated to the latest firmware to continue functioning as part of that speaker group. Google ends its blog post by saying it will work to minimize any additional changes. Google has been involved in a legal dispute with Sonos for a while now, with the latter claiming that the former has infringed on a number of its patents and licenses on its popular products. Now it seems that the lawsuit has proved to be favorable towards Sonos, as Google is being forced to make changes with its Nest speakers. Sonos had sought to block the sale of Google's smart speakers, Pixel smartphones, and even Chromebooks initially, but as of right now, it remains unclear which products and series would be facing the ban or revisions. It's all about money. ASML Holding, which supplies a vital technology used in computer chips, has reported a fire at a manufacturing plant. A fire at a factory owned by the sole provider of a vital technology used to manufacture computer chips could exacerbate an already serious global shortage of semiconductors. The blaze broke out overnight on January 4th at a plant in Berlin, Germany, owned by ASML Holding. The Dutch company is the world's largest supplier of photolithography systems and the only source of the extreme ultraviolet lithography machines, which are more advanced. These devices are used to etch circuits onto silicon wafers and create computer chips used by Apple, IBM, and Samsung. The world is experiencing a computer chip shortage due to a perfect storm of problems, including a global pandemic, a trade war, droughts, and snowstorms, and it has coincided with a period of unprecedented demand. Semiconductor factories have limited capacity, and building new plants requires massive investment and often takes several years. Although semiconductor companies are racing to increase production and governments are signing deals to bring plants to their own shores to guarantee supply, if ASML can't provide as many machines as expected, the shortage could continue for much longer. ASML Holdings said in a press release that it was too early to tell how significant the damage was and whether it will have any impact on production. The fire was extinguished during the night, and, fortunately, no persons were injured during this incident. The release said it would take a few days to conduct a thorough investigation and make a full assessment. Some of the end products that rely on ASML Holdings machinery have already been in dire shortage. The impact of the fire will depend on what was damaged, and whether that affects the most advanced chip-making technology, which has been less affected by existing shortages or older equipment. If its components used for lithography machines used to manufacture bleeding-edge processors, they might manage slightly better. If the fire damaged components used to manufacture the older nodes, they're in trouble because they need to urgently ramp up the manufacturing of such processors. ASML is entering 2022 with a lot of pent-up demand. If the fire is severe And if ASML struggles to recover quickly, we might need to get used to a tough semiconductor supply situation for the next 2 years. During the last few days, ASML conducted a preliminary assessment. The fire occurred in a part of one production building on the site in Berlin, and the smoke partly impacted an adjacent building. They have been able to resume production in parts of these buildings already. The other buildings on the other site have not been affected and are fully operational. Although the impact assessment of the damage is ongoing, their current view is the following. The metrology and inspection output of deep ultraviolet components has been restarted. Although there were some disruptions regarding these components, they expect to remediate this in such a way that it will not affect their output and revenue plan for the deep ultraviolet products. As to extreme ultraviolet, that's EUV, the fire affected part of the production area of the wafer clamp, a module in their EUV systems. They are still in the process of completing the recovery plan for this production area and determining how to minimize any potential impact for their EUV customers, both in their output plan and in their field service. On January 19, 2022, they will present their fourth quarter and full year 2021 results, as well as their initial view on the year 2022. And they expect to then also provide a further update on the fire incident. Why is ASML holding critical to the semiconductor industry? ASML is the only firm in the world capable of making the highly complex machines that are needed to manufacture the most advanced chips. These EUV machines, which cost approximately $140 million each, are sold to a handful of chipmaker giants, including Taiwan Semiconductor, Samsung, and Intel. At the beginning of the year, an estimated 400,000 sound recordings entered the public domain from before 1923. At the start of every year, we're treated to a large selection of content entering the public domain as it reaches 100 years since release. Books, film recordings, and our favorite of all, music. This means that the ownership of this content is now in the public's hands to do with as they wish. If you're wondering, does this mean that I can legally sample any music now in the public domain? Yes, you can, providing an amazing opportunity to take antique gold and transform it into something new within your music. As mentioned, there is a huge swath of recordings entered into the public domain on the 1st of January, 2022. The Association for Recorded Sound Collections have surveyed their members to find their 10 most notable recordings entering public domain in 2022. Seven experts got this selection down to 60 finalists, which were refined to 10 pieces by ARSC members. All genres and sound recordings types were eligible. This means that classical pieces, blues and jazz, spoken word, comedy or drama, or any other type of recording could have been shortlisted. I went through the list and I was surprised that the 10 selected, I was very familiar with almost all of them. Why are so many sound recordings entering the public domain in the year 2022? Up until now, sound recordings themselves have not been made public domain when they reached their 100th year since creation. Sound recordings were only added to the U.S. copyright law in 1972, leaving a question of whether sound recordings could be included 100 years from their inception or whether it applied from the date the law changed. U.S. copyright law has covered compositions since 1831, which includes the lyrics, chords, and melodies to a song. This means that any composition from over 100 years ago is free to be covered and re-recorded without legal question by anyone. When the sound recordings law was changed in 1972, state law suggested that no sound recording would become public domain until 2067. In 2018, the Music Modernization Act brought all pre-1972 recordings under federal law, with a plan for older recordings to be established by their date of release. This meant that those recordings would no longer be held by the date the law changed. The date that will see these changes begin to take effect is, well, the starting of this year. This means at the beginning of the year, we now see a large collection of an estimated 400,000 of sound recordings from 1922 and earlier enter public domain. The collection will include some of the earliest sound recordings and encompass content from opera, classical music, early blues, jazz, vaudeville, ragtime, popular songs, and spoken recordings such as comedy. Could you use a sample public domain sound recordings in your music? Yes, you can. Sample any sound recording that is in the public domain to your heart's content. If you can ensure that a recording is in the public domain, that means its ownership is as much yours as the original creators and owners. This makes public domain recordings an incredible resource for artists looking for interesting pieces to chop and use in their music with full certainty of their legal rights. The Library of Congress offers up all of the sound recordings which are available to the public free of charge at their National Jukebox. For those interested, the URL for the National Jukebox is loc.gov/collections/national-jukebox/about-this-collection/. I'll give it to our webmaster, this particular URL, and we can get this posted for you if you're interested. What was interesting is that before the 400,000 recordings being added this year, there were only 10,000 recordings already available, and these were donated from the Victor Talking Machine Company between 1901 and 1923. There's a huge collection of classical music that were recorded in 78 RPM format, and now it's available for all the opera lovers. Intuit opts out of participation in the IRS Free File program. TurboTax, which has been criticized for lacking transparency when it came to providing online access free of charge through the IRS site, has opted out of the Free File program. Intuit has elected not to renew its participation in the IRS Free File program and will no longer be offering IRS Free File program delivered by TurboTax. The news officially was released back in July, but most early filers don't start thinking about their taxes until January or February, and some are now surprised to learn of a significant change ahead for Free File. TurboTax is the second big name to stop participating. H&R Block exited Free File in October of 2020. It has been about 20 years since the IRS first entered into a special agreement to encourage tax software companies to provide free tax return software to a certain percentage of U.S. taxpayers. But in exchange, the bargain included getting the IRS to agree that it would not compete with these companies by providing its own software to taxpayers. Big names like Intuit's TurboTax and H&R Block faced much criticism back in 2019 after an investigation detailed how the companies limited the program's reach by making free options more difficult to find online and instead figuring out a way to steer eligible taxpayers into products that were not free. The report pointed out that Intuit added code to the Free File landing page of TurboTax that hid it from search engines like Google, making it hard to find. In January of 2020, the IRS announced some changes designed to offer more consumer protections. One such change, tax preparation firms agreed that they would not exclude Free File landing pages from an organic internet search. The IRS suggested that taxpayers search for standard labeling, IRS Free File program delivered by and in the name of the software provider. As part of the IRS Free File, taxpayers cannot be offered bank products that often carry fees, such as high-cost refund anticipation loans. if you use IRS Free File last year, the company you use is required to send you an email welcoming you back to their official IRS Free File services. The email must include a link to the company's IRS Free File site and explain how to file with it. If you choose this email link and qualify, you will not be charged for preparation and e-filing of a federal tax return. This year, 2021 tax returns are due April 18th, according to IRS instructions online for the tax season. Those who live in Maine and Massachusetts have until April the 19th because of Patriots Day holiday in those states. The majority of people buy tax software to do it themselves or hire tax professionals to handle the income tax returns. Millions of lower-income families and elderly people also turn to volunteers who prepare tax returns for free. Is there still free filing? The answer is yes. The Free File program at irs.gov gives eligible taxpayers free access to brand-name software programs offered by rival tax prep companies. Those who qualify can use online software that prompts filers with key tax questions, does the math, and allows you to file returns electronically for free. E-filing helps the IRS process returns and issues refunds more quickly than a return filed by paper. TurboTax was but one partner in Free File. Those who selected TurboTax last year are able to opt for another online tax preparation service in the Free File program. Last year, there were 9 tax software products available via Free File in English and 2 in Spanish. Who qualifies for Free File? If your adjusted gross income was $73,000 or less in 2021, you can use free tax software to prepare and electronically file your tax return, according to IRS instructions online for the 2021 tax season. If you earn more, you can use free file forms. Roughly 70% of the taxpayers based on income qualify for some software services offered, but only a small fraction of those who qualify actually use free file. More than 4.2 million taxpayers use one of the free online partner products that are part of free file in 2020, according to the data from the IRS. That is excluding the millions of non-filers who use a system to claim economic impact payments. Why has free file participation been so historically low, even after an uptick in 2020? Is it because taxpayers don't know about the heavily hyped free file? Or did taxpayers go online and end up being directed somewhere else for tax services? Some consumers report receiving emails from TurboTax in December alerting them that the company is no longer participating in Free File. TurboTax did release an announcement for its new no-cost, no-charge filing anyway, limited-time offer, which the company said it will apply to about 60 million filers with simple tax return. Tax filers using TurboTax Live Basic to file a simple return would pay nothing if they filed through March 31st. Filers have a February 15th deadline to use the TurboTax Live Full Service Basic to file a simple return for free. So, if you qualify for this, you have till February 15th to do it for free. Intuit said it had participated in Free File for nearly 20 years and has helped millions of Americans prepare and electronically file their tax return for free. Intuit blamed the lack of participation during the upcoming tax season on limitations of the Free File program and conflicting demands from those outside the program. Instead, the company's focus now on accelerating efforts that address other consumer financial challenges without the restraint of the Free File program. The IRS can and should create its own free tax preparation and filing system. Back in early 2020, before the pandemic hit, the IRS said it was no longer promising not to enter the tax return software and e-file service marketplace. The pledge no longer exists for not creating a government-run system. Going forward, it only makes sense for the IRS to work harder to give taxpayers even more access to no-cost software options for those willing to do their own tax returns. And Congress can also help by really simplifying the tax code. That wouldn't hurt either. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with the IT Pro Series. 5 Complaints for IT, Part 2 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about how you interact with information technology in your company, and oh yes, how they interact with you, and in this case, really more of what are the 5 complaints, the 5 biggest complaints that people have for IT departments. Now, last week, we talked about the helpless desk and customer service, and I hope I gave you some insight into how to address getting better service. We really are, in that one, I was trying to help you understand kind of that barrier there, and the barrier is actually, no offense, is the person who calls it the helpless desk, who has their various pet names for the service desk that are inappropriate in a world where everybody loves everybody. So, hey, that's just my approach to it. In this next one, it's the my kid knows more than you. My kid knows more than the IT department. My kid knows, look, insulting IT does not endear you to IT. Insulting your wife does not endear you to your wife. You know, the response we've heard? When the phone gets hung up, when the doors are closed, when everybody is not listening except for fellow IT people, yeah, we can get wicked wit. And yes, your kid knows more? Let them fix this. Okay. Let's not create an adversarial relationship with IT. That's not going to get you anywhere. Now, let's address your kids. Let's address the reality that your kids may be marvelous to you. They may seem absolutely astoundingly smart with technology, but your kid, odds are, your kid is not a hacking genius. They're willing to go in a different direction than you are. They're willing to try things out. They're willing to go down all kinds of different rabbit holes because they are digital natives. Now, what is a digital native? A digital native is somebody that, since the time that they grew up, they've been exposed to the digital world, to technology. They had a computer in the home back before anybody else did. They had, as far as age-wise, they had multiple computers in the home. They had all kinds of access to screens and tech that they just learned natively. I am one of the oldest digital natives you might have ever heard of. Yes, we're talking back in roughly 1980, we had a computer in the home. In 1983 or so, we had 2 computers in the home. We're talking about a progression where, yes, we had multiple computers around available to us, multiple types of computers, and some fairly advanced technology in my particular world. I'll tell you, I may have been brilliant with technology, but I lacked one thing: maturity. Yes, your kids, you know this as well. They may be a digital native, but they do lack the maturity to work in a workplace. They're not going to be disciplined. They're not going to get things done. So when you start telling IT that my kid knows more than you do about tech, no, they don't. And they also know very little about customer service and being insulted on a daily basis. Now, let's support your kids. Yes, someday your children may go into the tech field. I was absolutely sure that my son was going to go into the tech field. I was very sure that he was going to go down that path because he is brilliant with computers. He's a digital native amped up. He sits down at a computer, any type of computer, and he almost runs rings around me. But that's kind of how I exposed him to computers, and he and I actually have had some very good tech discussions. But what he did instead was he used his tech advantages, his tech knowledge, to climb the corporate ladder. Right now, he is making a good amount of money utilizing tech to his advantage. And there are other people out there that do the same thing, the people who are most conversant with tech and leverage tech the best are the ones that are climbing in the workforce. These people, whether we're talking about the youth or the people who've already moved from being a digital native into the corporate world, they all are leading us into a new tech future. And this new tech future is coming at us, and it's not going to be today or tomorrow. It may be decades from now. These people are all learning, the world of technology. They're learning all of these different things, and all of this knowledge is going to go forward to bring us collectively to a better place. So yes, your kid may know a lot, and I would encourage that. I would definitely strengthen their knowledge and their experience with tech, but understand, if you continue to insult IT and the service desk, they're not going to have any interest in going into that, or maybe even into IT itself. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. There are times we need to do a system restore of the operating system to a prior point in time because the operating system was corrupted or compromised. When that doesn't resolve the problem, the user then has the option of reinstalling the operating system. When this option is exercised, you can reinstall the operating system and keep the existing applications and data in place. You could also just refresh the hard disk drive or the solid-state drive with a clean copy of the operating system. However, whenever I do have the time, I normally would opt for a clean reinstallation as I don't know what else may have been corrupted in the operating system that has yet to appear. If you were to do a clean reinstall of the operating system, all data and applications are no longer part of the new operating system. However, the image of the replaced operating system with the existing applications and data is renamed in the subdirectory Windows.old. You can move the data from Windows.old to the newly reinstalled operating system, but you have to reinstall all the applications that were previously installed on the old operating system. You cannot just move it from one subdirectory to another unless it was a portable application. A portable app is a computer program that doesn't need to be installed into Windows like a traditional app, so you can carry it with you on a portable device or cloud drive and use on any Windows computer. When your USB flash drive, portable hard drive, or other portable device is plugged in or your cloud drive is synced, you have access to your software and personal data just as you would on your own PC. And when you unplug the device, none of your personal data is left behind. Of course, the portable app can also be permanently on your operating system drive. Portable applications offer some definite advantages over their traditional counterparts. They're lightweight, and they allow you to move between computers while taking your apps and settings with you. But here's why they're different. A portable app is simply one that doesn't use an installer. All the files required to run the app reside in a single folder, which you can put anywhere on the system. If you move the folder, the app will still work the same. While you may consider using a portable application, a portable app works as you move computers and your drive letters changes. A portable app is self-contained in a single directory with subdirectories and files within. Its features continue working as you move computers. It doesn't leave files or folders behind except those automatically generated by Windows. It doesn't leave registry entries behind except those automatically generated by Windows. A portable app is optimized for use on removable drives. It doesn't require additional software on the PC, and it doesn't interfere with software installed on the PC. If your favorite application is not available for download, you have the option to create your own portable application. Cameo, that's Cameyo, is a free application designed to create portable applications to run programs from anywhere. Upon launching Cameo, it takes a snapshot of your system, asks you to install the application that you want to see as portable, and then it takes a snapshot of the system to create portable applications. These programs are also called portable because you can run them on any computer, from any media, and they will work exactly the same as installed. As portable programs, there are huge advantages. Portable applications has its pros and cons, though. One advantage is the ability to run from any removable media. Portable software does not leave any traces in the registry. To be precise, any program makes a number of entries in the system registry, but their number is incomparable with those that leave behind installation packages of classic programs. Portable programs do not need installation and are easy to use. The file system of computer is not clogged. This is not the case with portable programs, which keeps all their files in one folder. Functionally, after reinstalling the operating system, in the case of portable software, it is enough to copy the necessary folder to a removable media, and after OS reinstallation, just move them back. There are disadvantages, though. The portable apps run at a relatively slow operation if it resides on an external portable device or cloud drive. Most portable programs do not notify the user about the release of a new version. There may be limited functionality when running larger applications. In such cases, some features are either missing or not working properly. Portable versions of applications do not need anything but free hard disk or solid-state disk drive space. They do not clog your computers with any unnecessary data, the existence of which you do not even know. You may ask, how do they not need computer resources if they still occupy space on the media? The fact is that they will take up space anyway, but the difference is that when you install the program, it's marked in the computer's registry. Such versions of programs can be found on the internet and easily downloaded for your computer for further use. You can create such programs yourself in Windows 10 or 8.1 or even 7. Portable apps come in really handy as executables, and any files associated with their operations are contained within a single folder, meaning you can run them directly from a USB drive or a cloud folder synced across PCs. Portable apps don't modify the Windows registry or leave behind configuration files on the host computer. This is especially useful in situations where you may not have administrative rights to install software. And looking at the bigger picture, just think about it. The Windows operating system is really a big customized portable application. Windows to Go was removed in Windows 10 version 2004 and later operating systems. What is Windows to Go from Microsoft? Windows to Go is a feature in Windows 8 Enterprise, Windows 8.1 Enterprise, Windows 10 Education, and Windows 10 Enterprise versions prior to the May 2020 update that allows a system to boot and run from certain USB mass storage devices such as USB flash drives and external hard disk drives, which have been certified by Microsoft as compatible. It is a fully manageable corporate Windows environment. The development of Windows to Go was discontinued by Microsoft in 2019 and is no longer available in Windows 10 as of the May 2020 update. However, you can create your own Windows to Go and the workaround to have it available for all variant versions of Windows. You don't need to have an enterprise version of Windows to have it. You can create your own Windows to Go as a portable operating system. Windows to Go workspaces can use the same image enterprise use for their desktops and laptops and can be managed the same way. Windows to Go is not intended to replace desktops, laptops, or supplant other mobility offerings. Rather, it provides support for efficient use of resources for alternative workplace scenarios. There are some additional considerations that you should keep in mind before you start to use Windows to Go. Windows to Go is not supported on Windows RT. There are differences between Windows to Go and a typical installation of Windows. Windows to Go workspace operates just like any other installation of Windows with a few exceptions. And these exceptions are that internal disks are offline. That's to ensure that data isn't accidentally disclosed and the internal hard disks on the host computer are offline by default when booted into a Windows to Go workspace. Similarly, if a Windows to Go drive is inserted into a running system, the Windows to Go drive will not be listed in Windows Explorer. Trusted Platform Module, that's TPM, is not used. When using BitLocker drive encryption, a pre-operating system boot password will be used for security rather than the TPM, since the TPM is tied to a specific computer and Windows to Go drives will move between computers. Hibernate is disabled by default to ensure that Windows to Go workspace is able to move between computers easily. Hibernation is disabled by default, but it can be re-enabled by using group policy settings. Windows Recovery Environment is not available in the rare case that you need to recover your Windows to Go drive. You should re-image it with a fresh image of Windows. Refreshing or resetting a Windows to Go workspace is not supported. Resetting to the manufacturer standard for the computer doesn't apply when running a Windows to Go workspace, so the feature was disabled. Upgrading a Windows to Go workspace is not supported. Older Windows 8 or Windows 8.1 Windows to Go workspaces cannot be upgraded to Windows 10 workspaces, nor can Windows 10 Windows to Go workspaces be upgraded to future versions of Windows 10. For new versions, the workspace needs to be re-imaged with a fresh image of Windows. Windows to Go drives can be booted on multiple computers. When a Windows to Go workspace is first booted on a host computer, it will detect all hardware on the computer and install any needed drivers. When the Windows to Go workspace is subsequently booted on that host computer, it will be able to identify the host computer and load the correct set of drivers automatically. The applications that you want to use from the Windows to Go workspace should be tested to make sure they also support roaming. Some applications bind to the computer hardware, which will cause difficulties if the workspace is being used with multiple host computers. To replace the hard disk drive with a solid-state drive, I have been using Macrium Reflect Free to do a clone of the hard disk drive of an installed operating system onto a solid-state drive. Macrium Reflect Free allows you to back up your entire computer along with all the hidden partitions and schedule backups. When the hard disk drive physically replaced by the solid-state drive after the cloning process, everything worked fine. I then moved the hard disk drive into an external USB case. When I changed the BIOS to boot up from the USB external drive, which in this case was the original hard disk drive on the system, everything came up and with the operating system running slightly slower. There's two reasons for this. The solid-state drive boots up much quicker than a hard disk drive. The other is the data transfer speed on the internal SSD is inherently faster than a hard disk drive. I repeated the same process with a high-speed SD card. The SD card just runs slower. In fact, too slow to be used. In addition to Macrium Reflect Free, there are other tools available to create your own Windows to Go. There is also Win2USB, that's WinToUSB, and EaseUSB OS to Go, that's EaseUS, OSTOGO. The basic concept is to have a mirror of the internal system storage boot up from an external storage source. The external destination of the clone device needs to be equal or greater than the internal storage device. The boot up of the created Windows to Go will work when used with the original system it was created from and like models. It may or may not work with other systems as the BIOS setup varies from one manufacturer to the other. Creating the Windows to Go from a minimally defined hardware system would enable it to be more identifiable with other hardware systems. Create your own Windows to Go with a solid-state drive, else you will find the operating speed to not be practical to use. Give it a try. You'll have fun with it. Presenting Technology Chatter of Hits and Misses with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston. Star Trek Fun and Ideas.
One of my fondest memories of Thanksgiving actually was the Star Trek marathons on KTLA Channel 5. Marty, you know, Marty, I just sit here and I wonder, you know, how awesome would it have been to, like, synthesize, you know, have the food replicator make your turkey dinner instead of slaving hours over, you know, the, pull it down to the oven. Is it good? No, you got to put it in for another 20 minutes, whatever. Yeah, just amazing stuff.
You want to build that stuff? I mean, what if we had to invent Star Trek tech today?
Oh, yeah.
You're reaching a nerd or two, a geek or three. Sure, maybe sure. You can come up with something. And you know, let's all also acknowledge. Mm-hmm. Some of that stuff's already here. The Star Trek communicator is a piker. It doesn't run apps. Doesn't take pictures.
I just saw a cartoon on that. Hey, yeah. when do you think we're going to get pictures on these? Yeah, okay, yeah.
All right, and for that matter, mm-hmm. The tricorder could be an app.
Yeah, a lot of what they had in the tricorder. I mean, okay, you would need the FLIR infrared add-on for your phone,
or the little salt shaker with a flashing lens.
sure.
Pardon me. There's always some way to do this. Phasers. What if we needed a phaser? Mm-hmm. I think you could build a phaser with high power ultrasonics and the heterodyne effect. For those of you who don't know the heterodyne effect, it's like math class in signals. You get the original thing and the difference and the sum, and you choose the one you want to filter and let through. But listen, ultrasonics can do magical work as a weapon. It can make your opponent dizzy. If you're in Cuba at the embassy, it can make them downright ill. Yeah. So ultrasonics may be the key for that. And I believe there's a small blood vessel at the base of the brain that ultrasonics can make a fatal effect. But
ooh, I wasn't aware of that one. Okay.
Let's use that next year on the turkey.
Wow.
Now, what other tech would you like to deal with? The shields? Well, that's pretty easy. We can build them right now out of bricks. And then there is the disruptors. Those are Klingon.
Yes, they are.
And all you need for that is teenagers.
Okay. I get that the teenagers are disruptive, but...
What, we're Klingons?
Oh, man.
There was a time of war when they weren't good guys.
There was, yeah.
Now, do you want to have a stealth ship? Do you want to be able to go invisible like about half the vessels in every episode? Well, that's really easy. First of all, if you're making the series, it means you don't have to create the dang vessel. But then if you're in real life, all you have to do is hide behind something dark. So, you know, take a dirigible in space.
Yeah, that one kind of crashed.
Warp drive is easy. Just read Facebook.
Okay. Oh, and, man.
You know, if you want to cross the universe, ask yourself, were you invited? Do they really want to see you?
Oh, man. You know, and okay, so let's bring it down to practical, though. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to teleport away from Grandma's house when all of the politics discussions got going?
Yeah, or to teleport those people who are talking about them.
Scotty, beam Uncle Charlie out of here.
That's now, teleportation, assuming they can get beyond the quantum linking, teleportation's limitation is that it's far more bandwidth than even fiber brings to the house. So maybe with a new infrastructure program, we can improve the fiber to the bandwidths that allow us to just, you know, get blown down the line like a pneumatic tube message system in offices in the 30s. And, you know, we've got the space station up there. I think if you tie a radar to a sound effects generator and something goes by, it can go whoosh, like on the series.
Sure, yeah.
So Star Trek isn't that far. Now, there are some things that happen in Star Trek Discovery that we wouldn't want to deal with when they actually told us how that 32nd century food replicator works. But for those of you who don't watch, I'll spare you the details.
Oh, man. I when was that? Was that in one of the recent episodes?
Third season, yes.
Third season, latter half, I'm presuming. I only saw like the first quarter of the third season. Yeah.
It happened when the enemy lady and the Star Trek Authority first meet and they're having apples together.
I missed that. Okay. All right. Should I go watch that?
No, not when
I'm hungry.
However, I note now when we're recording this, it has not happened yet, but we are, I believe, yes, less than a week from the fourth season debut.
Ooh, wow.
That may be fun.
Very cool. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The 46th Annual Trenton Computer Festival, TCF 2022, is set for Saturday, March the 19th, 2022. The theme of the festival is Disrupting Climate Change with Technology. It will be held at the College of New Jersey in Trenton, New Jersey. The keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, and he is the co-director of the University Office of Climate Action. He is a climate and sea level scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University's Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences and Rutgers Institute of Earth and Ocean and Atmospheric Sciences. TCF will be a full day of learning and fun. For more information, you can go to tcf-nj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, January 13, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, January the 14th, 2022, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, January the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. It's a virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is pcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.